I was lucky enough to be given a tour of Tynwald, which was completely fascinating. If, like me, you are interested in how politics works, to talk about, which I did with the president of Tynwald, he was very kind to give me his time, to talk about how the House of Keys works with 24 people, with obviously a ministerial group that can't be more than half, but you still have to assemble all of that. And we talked about, you know, what happens, which I know has been a sort of fairly recent event, what happens when someone resigns, how do you deal with collective responsibility, what do you do about scandals, and the fascinating question, how do you maintain independence rather than party positions? So for anybody who's interested, as I am, in the kind of mathematics of politics, when you start talking about politics with small groups like that, it's really, really interesting. So I was completely riveted by it. Really, really real privilege.
And you're no stranger to politics. You were obviously an advisor to Sir John Major. The UK has a very defined party politics system. But obviously, like you said, the Isle of Man has almost no party politics. What are your thoughts on a parliamentary system where there is almost no party political influence?
Well, it's fascinating. And in some ways, obviously, it's the ideal because you get greater independence. If you were to look in a mathematical way at how politics works, the one thing you wouldn't want to do is to say to people, one, you all have to agree with each other. And two, you must never admit your mistakes, right? And that's those are the two organising principles of much of party politics. You've got to agree with everyone else and never admit your mistakes. Whereas if you were trying to organise something that was optimal for decision making, you would always admit your mistakes, and also you would use all the diversity of opinion to create a collective wisdom. So yours is a much better system. And the only reason that you're able to work that is because, you know, 1,600 votes is enough to get a front row seat. And so you can know your voters and you can be more constituency orientated rather than party orientated. In a British political system, the problem is that there are so many voters, you can't do that. When I ran for Parliament, ran a couple of times, I realised that physically, if I divided up the amount of time it took me to go to each door, I simply couldn't visit every member of the electorate and talk to them in a way that you would like to in order to be their representative and persuade them that you should be allowed to do that. Because I couldn't do that, you have to give them broad gauge messages, and then, of course, you need to organise yourself in the form of parties in order just to give people a few simple messages and get them across on television, because, you know, there's a limited bandwidth. I guess social media may give back that possibility of connecting individual politicians with individual electors. It's at least possible. It doesn't seem to be going that way, does it? It does seem to be encouraging everybody to kind of go in behind everyone else, and maybe that's just a human capability. But I was really impressed by that sense of independence and reliance on constituency that you have here, and, you know, long may it last.
That's interesting, because that's almost a point which is a lot of people criticise, is having so many politicians for such a small space. We do have a tricameral system as well. Do you think that works for getting things done in a timely manner?
Well, look, when people say they don't like to have politicians, obviously what everyone would really like to do is, my father used to have a joke. He used to say the best committee is a committee with two people on it and the other person can't come. Right. And I think that's what most people think, which is the best political decisions are ones I make for myself. But that's not representative of the diversity of view. So you can't have that. And if you don't have that, unless everybody's going to be busy all the time on politics, you need politicians. I've actually got this in a fairly direct way. I'm a member of the House of Lords, and the House of Lords, it's not a house of politicians. People are supposed to have and do have other roles, and some people are retired and they can spend all their time on it. Other people like me are not retired, and often when there are important matters coming up in the House of Lords, I find that I've got a meeting of something else that somebody's paying me to do, and I need to be at that. I realise that you can't expect every person in the country to be directly engaged with what your policy is going to be. You need to have politicians. So I don't think, you know, with a house of 24 people and then, having nine effectively in LegCo, you've got too many people. for doing that job, because you need an intermediary between people who've got to get on with their lives and people who are working in Parliament, who can really kind of focus in on the issues. I remember once going to my brother-in-law, I'd help William Hague, whom I worked with, on Prime Minister's Questions, and I said to my brother-in-law, "Did you watch Tony Blair's response?" And he went, "No, I was working," because he's in advertising, and I laughed because, of course, in my sort of little micro world, everyone was like working for the leader of the opposition and watching Prime Minister's Questions, and that's not what they do. Mm. They're getting on with their lives. So you need politicians. If you don't have politicians, what are the choice? One, people making direct decisions for themselves on issues they haven't got time to consider properly or the expertise. The other alternative is you have one person and you don't elect them, right? You have some sort of dictatorship. If you're not going to have either of those, and I think people can immediately see that neither of them would be desirable, you're going to have elected politicians. So people can complain about having too many politicians or who the politicians are, but they also have to think, well, it takes a certain mindset to want to be a politician, and you'd actually need that mindset. People need to, for example, I was talking to somebody on the way between lunch and the hotel in my amazing overview of life here. A slightly luxurious thing to do, to go in a taxi between one and the other. But we were talking about, and he was saying, oh, politicians are just always trying to please people. And I said, well, that's really what you're paying for. They are trying to please the electorate as well as represent their own principles and views, because and you need people who've got skills in doing that. And that is a particular skill set. And interestingly, when you watch, well, let's give an example. When you watch someone who isn't particularly skilled at doing it, and I would say, oddly, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, of Keir Starmer, who's a very clever man and also a nice person, and I think, in my experience, ethical, certainly intelligent, but he's not very good at politics. And actually everyone who most of them complains about political skills and politicians trying to do things in interviews, when it's not there, everyone thinks, oh, it'd be better if he was a bit more politically skilled.
Let's talk about some of your kind of your other job. You said that you're a member of the House of Lords. Obviously, you were the executive editor of The Times for a period too. What do you feel is the future for newspapers?
Oh, that's an important. So, of course, you can say there's a real challenge to newspapers now. And we provide people with two things, okay? One is we provide them with content, news content of the type that you're brilliantly conveying, live Daniel Finkelstein interview to your listeners. lucky them. We provide them with content. And the other thing, which as you're aware, we provide, is editing, right? So it's edited content. It's not just content. So let's say when I was comment editor of The Times, somebody who's a rabbi would send me an article on ethics, and I would read that article, decide whether it was something that Times readers would want to know, written in a way that they would find comprehensible, and make a decision about running it. And sometimes I would run it, and sometimes I wouldn't run it. A free media would just publish it anyway and make you read it and make that decision. So what we're doing, edited content, means I've read it. I think this is true, reasonable, intelligent. And I think there is a need for that. But clearly we'll be challenged on both those things. So first of all, there's a huge amount of content. It's much easier to create content, and people can convey that content using social media channels. And secondly, AI will provide people with editing tools, so they'll be able to home in on the things that they want, build their own algorithms about the news feeds that they want, and maybe they'll make good choices. Maybe sometimes they'll cut out too much serendipity with too much calculation, but they'll do it. It'll work reasonably well. So it's a challenge to both things that we charge people for. The Times charges people for content. It charges people for editing, and both of those things are under challenge. But I think there are a number of ways in which we're helped. First of all, it's a lot easier for us to gather that content. Secondly, we no longer have to print it all on very expensive pieces of paper. Right? Used to be said, don't argue with people who order ink by the barrel, right? You know, which was talk about newspaper proprietors. And I remember talking to Rupert Murdoch about how the him saying to me, the price of ink is a big, big factor in whether this paper's profitable or not. Right. And obviously, if you cut that out, the costs of the paper are easier to control, and also it's a lot cheaper, so you can reach more people. And we've also got those AI tools to use ourselves. But finally, and the most important, I think there is a market for the authenticity and accuracy that only human intervention can guarantee. What people want is not only to have something true presented to them, but they want to know that it's true. And they want the reassurance that they're dealing with professionals who are making that judgment. And I think the Times, if you look at the history of the Times, in my view, there's never been a moment where we are providing people with so much accurate and broad content. When I'm writing a column, I can't imagine how a columnist would have done this 50 years ago, the sort of research that I can do now so quickly. And even I couldn't 10 years ago do the research that I can do now. So the information I'm providing people is better and better. I'll give you one example. I started my column written at the Labour Party conference last week. I started it with a quote from the dock workers leader, Ben Tillett. I had that quote in my head. I knew that it was there, but I also knew that it was in Martin Pugh's book called Speak for Britain, and that was a history of the Labour Party. I was in Liverpool, so I wasn't at home, but I had 2,000 books. In fact, I've got them here, right here. I'm just slapping them on the table and causing an annoyance to your microphone. 2,000 books here, which I was able to access. Well, I couldn't have done that even before the Kindle, and he probably wouldn't have known that quote was there to put in his book before the internet.
Final thoughts. I just want to touch on something that I'm particularly curious about. You said in 2020 you were on a podcast. You said journalists having to see both sides of the argument can be a curse rather than a blessing, and it can be stifling. What did you mean by that?
When I do an article, I certainly try to understand both points of view, because if you don't understand the criticisms of the argument you're putting forward, you don't understand the holes in it, you will leave the reader sitting there thinking, well, there's an obvious point he's missed here. So you want to think of that and try to cover it off in your argument. So one of the things I always do is think, right, what are the counter points to the point that I've made in my article? But when you're an opinion journalist, it can be quite sort of oppressive to realise there's actually two legitimate points. You can end up in a quite a tangle, because actually there isn't only one article, but I think it's only one view. But I think it's quite a good tangle to be in, to be honest. I think it's a good challenge. So I'll give you a controversial example, but I was on BBC Question Time the day after the general election, and a young lady asked me a very articulate question about Gaza. She was obviously, from the way she was dressed, she was Muslim. I'm Jewish. And I think the implication of her question was, you know, she wanted to know about she was offended by the Israeli government's policy in Gaza. And I said, I see you've got a piece of paper, which is, by the way, perfectly fine for her to have a piece of paper with her points on it. And I said, and I've also got pieces of paper with my points of view on it. And what we can do, if you like, is we can read to each other what we've got on our piece of paper. And you're going to read me a load of very legitimate points, all of which are probably right. And I can read you back mine, and I promise you they're also right. And what we've got absolutely nowhere. A much better approach might be if we swapped our piece of paper and you read my points and I read yours, and we are trying to understand each other. What I'm trying to say is, I think when you're trying to be like opinionated and punchy, it can sometimes be a bit arresting to realise there's actually a very good answer to the points you're making. But if you want to get anywhere constructive in politics, that is the most important thing to understand.
Thank you for making it to the end of the Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.